Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. It is January 16th as we record this, which means it's that special time of year where the entire continent is frozen, covered in snow, very wintry outside, and yet we're less than a month away from pitchers and catchers reporting to spring training. So let's talk about what's going on in the offseason. Still a lot of stuff left to do. With me this week to talk about it is Tim Durkas. How you doing, Tim?
Hey, I'm doing good, Dara. Happy to be here. Yeah, it's about 0 degrees where I am, and kids are home from school on a cold day, which is weird, but...
So 0 degrees yes. Fahrenheit. Explain it to me. I'm in Canada, and we, the rest of the world, we use the metric system.
You're on the right track. We're weird. it is insanely cold, but I'm in the suburbs of Chicago, and that's just, you just get used to it, so yeah. I'm fine with it.
It is cold here in Toronto as well, and it is snowing, yeah. But like I said, baseball is, you know, just over the horizon. Okay, so speaking of the winter, the Cubs have kind of been in hibernation for most of this offseason. Nice segue, huh? they came out of hibernation, making the two most significant moves of their offseason in sort of quick succession in the past week. The first one was just breaking as we were recording the last episode of this podcast, but we didn't really have the details. They landed Shota Imanaga, left-handed pitcher coming over from Japan. Sort of an unusual contract structure, not like totally unprecedented or anything. We've seen these sort of like convoluted option structures before. I think Yusei Kikuchi had one and somebody else whose name is escaping me right now. But it's like a four-year, $53 million guarantee. But then there's two different instances where there's either an opt-out where the Cubs can add a fifth year and make it like 580 after 2025 and 2026 seasons. A lot going on there. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, the Cubs have these different decision points, and it is kind of interesting. This is just like a very Cubs contract, a very 2024 Cubs type of thing to do. It reminds me, oddly, a little bit of like Dansby Swanson from last winter, where they didn't really engage at the top of that shortstop market, but they wanted a very good player, and they seemed like they had their own limits on what they would do financially, and they stuck to those, and they came away with a good player in Swanson. And I think this is a little bit similar in that you had Yamamoto kind of overshadowing Imanaga, and that Yamamoto is just simply better and younger, and both pitchers made sense for the Cubs, but I think the Cubs just weren't willing to, put out that level of money for Yamamoto, and didn't seem like they were in that at the end. So Imanaga basically serves as a Marcus Stroman replacement for the Cubs, but at a lower salary. And this is a lower guarantee than what we thought. But I think that there's always kind of uncertainty with a guy who's never pitched in the majors before. But if you look at the way that this is set up, the Cubs are paying Imanaga $23 million for the next 2 years. So kind of like a Kenta Maeda type of arrangement. But if you throw in the posting fee, then that brings you up to kind of the Michael Wacha price tag of, roughly $32, $33 million over those 2 years. And so I think that Imanaga has more upside than a Wacha or a Nick Martinez or something. And so I think that, that's a good starting point for those 2 years. And then after that, I would look at it, Imanaga is going to his age 32 season after the 2025 season. The Cubs basically have a three-year, $57 million option on him. So it's a very close comparable to Dallas Keuchel, who's the same age, signed for a very similar contract, and probably was a point of reference in doing this deal. So I think if Imanaga is, good enough in 25, the Cubs will do that. But if they decline, then he has a one-year $15 million deal, which these days is pretty cheap. It's a pretty low bar to clear. So I think that for him to want to pick that up, he'd have to be hurt or have pitched really poorly. So that's kind of how I kind of see that playing out.
So it seems like maybe there were, like is often the case with guys coming from overseas, there's, teams have differing viewpoints on how to value them. you know, there was some comparisons to Kadai Senga earlier in the offseason. So, you know, we were sort of like looking at that as a reference point when putting the top 50 together. Maybe he could get something like 575, which is what Senga got, but I think we bumped it to 85. And then there were reports that the starting pitching market was very strong and he was actually going to get over 100 million, but he barely got half of that. So why do you think that he ended up lower than it seemed, you know, a couple months ago?
I do think it's a matter of, you know, varying evaluations of him. I think that possibly some desire to pitch to be with the Cubs specifically caused him to turn down bigger offers. We don't really have details on that. And like the Red Sox, for example, were in on him, but did not come in with a better offer from what's been reported. But it's possible he was offered a larger guarantee. But, you know, he really seemed interested in Chicago specifically. He spent time here in advance of the deal. And the Cubs have had a pretty good presence in Japan. And they have Seiya and they had Yu Darvish before. I think what's interesting about Imanaga is that from what I've read, it seems like he could reasonably land anywhere from a number three all the way to a number five starter, which the gulf between those two is huge. You know, and so Baseball America's scouting report does say that he looks like kind of like a number four or a number five. But if you read, you know, some of the stuff from Eno Saris of The Athletic, just about kind of his pitch repertoire and the data that they have from the World Baseball Classic, it's pretty optimistic. And, you know, it's that data suggests that he could have three plus pitches, whereas Baseball America is kind of in the mode of saying that he has two, his fastball and his splitter. And I think there's maybe a little bit of divide on whether his slider is as good as it looked in the World Baseball Classic or something worse. But he only throws about 92, 92.2 was his average on his fastball. So he's not a super hard thrower these days, but I think that from what I've read, his fastball has a ton of ride and is actually a very effective pitch. He's got great control. And so when I thought about him, I saw some similarities to Masahiro Tanaka. Similar velocity, reliance on the splitter, great control, prone to home runs, though. And so when you look at Tanaka and you kind of look at his baseball reference page, just for an example, he had a 3.07 ERA. One year, he's getting Cy Young votes, and then the next year, he has a 4.74 ERA. I don't think that his skills changed a lot in those 2 years. I think that when you're a guy who gives up a lot of fly balls and a lot of home runs, you know, sometimes they leave the yard and sometimes they don't. And so I think that that's going to kind of drive Tanaka. And then, you know, one Tanaka did rack up a decent amount of innings, especially I think he had like a UCL tear too early on. But Imanaga is small. There's going to be questions about his durability, but he doesn't really have like a scary injury history. So the Cubs, you know, might be able to get innings out of him. So that's kind of where I see him from a scouting perspective.
Yeah, I heard the home run things were apparently a concern for the Yankees. So I guess it'll be interesting. His fate might be in the hands of those Wrigley Field wins for the next few years for Imanaga. Okay, so that's one move bolstering, like you said, a sort of Stroman replacement for their rotation. They also made a very interesting trade. The Dodgers sent Michael Busch and Yency Almonte to the Cubs for prospects Jackson Ferris and Zaire Hope. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Apologies if not. How did you feel about this trade, Tim?
I was surprised by it. As the person who wrote the offseason outlook for the Cubs, and I do that every year at MLB Trade Rumors, you know, I thought I had mostly gamed out the different things that the Cubs might do to fill first base. And I thought with there being kind of several possible short-term free agents that they could easily throw in there, that they would take that route. So I didn't think that they would trade for a guy who was a rookie last year, who really hasn't played first base much in the majors or in the majors at all, you know, who is basically blocked on the Dodgers. But it strikes me as potentially clever. You know, I think this trade is all about Busch. He's 26. He's had limited big league exposure with the Dodgers, who didn't really have a great spot for him. So they're kind of playing him out of position, whether it was second or third. You know, when Busch was going to be ready for the majors, I think they had Muncy at first in 2021, and after that they had Freddie Freeman. So it's just, you know, he first base wasn't going to work for Busch. And so the Cubs definitely have that opening for him and can plug him in there. I mean, if he can kind of hit, like when I try to think of somebody who performs kind of an average way for a first baseman. I look at maybe what Josh Bell did last year. It was fine. It was kind of average. I think if Bush, as a 26-year-old rookie, could do something like that and then maybe build upon it or even a little bit better, then the Cubs would be thrilled. And so if he gets into the Nathaniel Lowe territory, maybe like 15% above league average as a hitter, that would be a huge win for the Cubs, who control him for 6 years. But I mean, the Cubs do already have a similar player to this in Matt Mervis. I don't think he had quite the prospect pedigree, at least not early on in his career. But, you know, Mervis had runway of about a month under David Ross, and the Cubs are trying to win. He didn't hit. He didn't even come back up. So, you know, if Bush doesn't hit the ground running or isn't like at least an average hitter within a month or two, you know, I think the Cubs will again be searching for something else to do at first base.
It also seems like they have another bat-first guy with defensive question marks in Christopher Morel. And there was some talk earlier in the offseason that they were going to move him to first, because I think some people think he's actually like a plausible second baseman, a passable second baseman. But the Cubs have, you know, Swanson and Horner up the middle, so they can't really put him there. And so there was talk of moving him to first. So with Morel and Bush and Mervis, is do you see all these pieces fitting together? Do they need to make a trade?
Yeah, I think that Mervis starts to feel a little bit like trade bait, because he's 26 as well, and you don't really want a guy languishing in the minors much longer, because then he starts to move over from old prospect to quad A guy. So it's kind of like, I think that if Bush over the first half looks like he's going to stick and be the answer, or be a solid answer, then by the deadline, then Mervis probably looks like trade bait. On Morel, Morel's interesting. I think the Cubs haven't really answered how that's going to go, or it's a little confusing to me. I think that they showed interest in Morel playing first base in winter ball, but it wasn't really up to the Cubs, and so I don't think that he did. And so the Cubs haven't seemed all that interested in kind of calling Morel their third baseman, or pushing their chips in on the idea of Morel at third. And, you know, Bush and Morel can both play third technically, but I don't think Bush is known for having a good arm, whereas Morel does have a really good arm. And so if you could kind of get his other aspects of defense, if you could get those up from, you know, subpar to average, combined with a still pretty interesting bat, he could be your third baseman. But the Cubs have not really seemingly approached things in that way with Morel. So I feel like tentatively he's slated as a designated hitter who probably will kind of moonlight in the field a little bit.
Okay, so interesting moves for the Cubs after a couple of months of waiting for the Cubs fans. In another like Cubs-related move, Marcus Stroman, who was with the Cubs last year, as we mentioned, he opted out of his deal with the Cubs and signed with the Yankees for 2 years, $37 million, with a vesting player option thing for 2026. Your thoughts on this deal, Tim?
I think this is a case of the Yankees adding some mid-rotation innings at a contract that met expectations, or at least met our expectations. Stroman turns 33 in May. He had a weird injury last year, a rib cartilage fracture that he said he didn't know how he got. And, you know, it's not an injury that I recall ever seeing a baseball player have. So it's odd, but, you know, he did get back on the mound. So I don't think that that's a concern going into 2024. I think he'll be fine. I know that he grew up a Yankees fan. He really wanted to play there. And, you know, he said things about the Yankees and Brian Cashman and stuff in the past, but he's kind of he's an outspoken and interesting guy. Like, how many MLB players have written children's books? You know, so he's going to be interesting. He has a large Twitter following, speaks his mind, and he has clashed with the fans and the media over the years. But I don't necessarily think there's going to be a problem here with that. I'm a little more focused on, you know, what are his abilities and his durability at this stage in his career. And, you know, he's not a guy who misses bats. He keeps the ball on the ground. Cubs, I think, probably were hoping for 170, 180 innings a season when he was with them, and he fell short of 140 each year. So, you know, it kind of remains to be seen whether he can kind of get back into the level of a 2024 innings eater, which I think is 160 plus. But the Yankees needed kind of some, just some bulk innings that are probably going to be decent. And that's pretty much what they're getting here.
Yeah, because they have Gerrit Cole at the front. And then prior to the Stroman signing, there was a few question marks. You know, Carlos Rodon and Nestor Cortez both dealt with their own injuries last year. And so, and then they traded away a lot of depth pieces and, you know, Michael King in the Soto deal. So there's lots of uncertainty there. So, yeah, like you said, if they can get 150-something innings out of Stroman with his ground balls, you know, that would be very nice. Do you think that this reflects, because there were some reports that the Yankees were in on higher targets like Snell, Montgomery, Dylan Cease, but it seems like, not to say that they definitely can't pivot to those guys still, but that the asking prices were kind of on the high side and that they moved to Stroman because they didn't want to pay, you know, $200 million, whatever, for Snell, or, you know, give up four of their best prospects to get Dylan Cease or something. So does this signing say something about the where the starting pitching market is right now?
Yeah, I think so. I think with no inside info, my guess here on the Yankees is that they specifically signed Stroman in a response to not wanting to pay those prices. That's pretty reasonable to assume. I think that the big free agents, the guys that we think are going to go for $150 million plus, my guess is that the Yankees are kind of moving away from that unless these guys, you know, fall short and take like kind of bargain-ish contracts. I think in the trade market, though, I would expect Cashman to stay engaged there because it would not be hard to add another like really good starting pitcher and just kind of push everybody down. So I think if the price drops for Cease to the Yankees, you know, level that they like, they would pull the trigger. I think if they could do something interesting for a Jesus Luzardo, they would still do it. So my guess is that the Yankees would still be engaged in the trade market. You know, they came into this winter wanting Yamamoto, and then you come away with Stroman, who, you know, is said to be this high floor guy, but I don't know. I mean, he wasn't that reliable with the Cubs. He's getting up there in age, so I'm not sure the floor is as high as people might think or as it was a few years ago. And then you've got, you know, like you said, Rodon and Cortez, and it's like, yikes. I mean, if I would hate to see this, but, you know, what if Gerrit Cole got hurt? Like, what would this team do? So they kind of, they need something more there.
All right. Well, another team that was sort of connected, or maybe still is connected, to the big starting pitching targets. The Giants have been rumored to be interested in Snell and Montgomery and all those kinds of guys, Yamamoto, but they pulled off a different kind of move. They signed Jordan Hicks, who, other than a few scattered starts in his career, has been a reliever. But he got a four-year, $44 million deal with the Giants. And the Giants are apparently going to let him try to start. So what do you make of this?
You know, we've seen this a little bit here and there in free agency, kind of a guy who started in the past and seems like he really wants to. And so the team goes ahead and signs him for like good reliever money with the nice fallback that if he can't start and if that fails, then they don't really mind having that player in the bullpen. I think the Braves with Reynaldo Lopez are taking that approach. And I think like looking at a success story was when the Rangers signed Mike Minor. You know, he came and kind of moved back into the rotation and was successful there. So you have to keep in mind, like sometimes it's really important when they're finally picking their own team, a player in free agency, some of these guys never really wanted to stop starting and can put that at the top of their list. And if they find a team that's willing to do that, then they can find a match. You know, being in the Chicago area, I've always got some of these old Cubs deals on my mind. And one that comes to mind for me with Hicks, which is a weird comp, but Alfonso Soriano, when the Cubs signed him, which I looked up was 17 years ago, which makes me feel really old. But when the Cubs signed Soriano, it was an 8-year deal. And I remember that part of the plan was to use him in center field, which he had never played to that point. And that lasted all of 12 games into an 8-year contract. So it's kind of like what teams say in terms of the role, especially if it's outside the player's norm and his history. I don't put that much stock in what they're saying that they might do. I totally believe that they're going to give him starts in April. Beyond that, I think it's anybody's guess. And I think the question with Hicks, everybody would agree, is like, well, how much can he hold up? Can he put up 140 innings? I think most people would bet against that. But I think the Giants are also in a position where they're getting, hopefully getting Robbie Ray and Alex Cobb like in the second half. And so if they give Hicks, you know, 2-3 months of runway, and if it's not working out for some reason, or if he gets hurt, which he does have a pretty long history of, then he can move to the bullpen and he can be a late inning reliever again. And this is fine. I think he's a guy whose results have never quite matched his stuff, but he's 27 years old. He can throw a ball 105. So I could see the obvious appeal of Jordan Hicks.
Yeah, and it's been done more recently. I mean, Minor is a good example that you gave, but like Seth Lugo, Michael Lorenzen are a couple more recent examples of relievers moving to a rotation job with some success. But it seems like the Giants probably still have to make more moves for this rotation because, you know, you mentioned Ray and Cobb, but they are going to be starting the season on the injured list. So now it's sort of Logan Webb and then a couple shrug emojis in like Hicks and Ross Stripling and like Kyle Harrison, who has like, I don't know, like a handful of starts. There's a lot of uncertainty after Webb there.
I think so. And you know, Blake Snell, I think they've been connected to him, you know, in some regard, but he's never really seemed like a Giants type of signing, especially, you know, if Boris is to be successful in getting him like a 6 or a 7 year deal. That's pretty hard for me to picture. So I think that they could probably use some more depth, but that, you know, if you're not playing in the Snell Montgomery price range, that nobody they're going to add is going to be all that exciting unless they go after some of the, you know, aforementioned trade targets. If they go and get Cease or something, okay, great. You know, you got some reliability and some innings there, but you know, the Giants based on their history seem more likely to like go add James Paxton or something. I could see them doing something like that. And it's like, if you pile up enough of these guys, maybe they can get you through the first half. They've never seemed overly concerned about having like a 1-5 of, you know, known reliable starting pitchers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, one other piece of news we wanted to hit before we move on to listener questions. Atlanta extended president of baseball operations, Alex Anthopoulos, a huge extension by front office standards through 2031. So it's like 7 extra years when most, you know, GMs, presidents, they get kind of 3, 4, 5 year deals. Pretty big in terms of what we normally see. How were you struck by this?
I'm not too surprised. I think Anthopoulos is regarded as one of the best, you know, GMs or executives in the game. But yeah, I agree. The length is surprising, but, you know, it's not a crazy thing that they would want to do this. So it kind of reflected on his tenure a little bit, and he's been Braves GM for 6 years now. And he took over, if you recall, he took over from John Coppolella after that stuff happened. And at that point, the Braves were considered a rebuilding team. But, you know, Anthopoulos, I think, is more about continuing and not messing up what he was given than he is about acquiring most of the talent that has led to the Braves' success, if that makes sense. So, I mean, they already had Acuna and Austin Riley, Max Fried, Freddie Freeman, Ozzie Albies, and Dansby Swanson. All those guys were in the organization at that point. And I'm not trying to detract from Anthopoulos, who brought in, you know, who drafted, for example, Spencer Strider and Michael Harris. But all those players I named, if you inherit a team with those players, you are in a really good spot. They won the division, I think, all 6 years. They, of course, won the World Series in 2021. But, you know, Anthopoulos' signature thing, I think, has been giving out these extensions. I think, by my count, he's given out 18 of them. He's locked up guys on, you know, what have looked like really good contracts from a team standpoint and has created a ton of stability. I don't know how much credit goes to Anthopoulos for that. I don't know. You know, you need to have players and agencies that are willing to do all that. So, you know, there are certainly Ronald Acuna Jr. equivalent or similar talents who simply would not take that contract. So, you know, kind of the right place, the right time, but he still got those deals done. I think part of the reason they locked him up and that they love him, Braves ownership, is that he is kind of an owner's dream in that in free agency, he's only once given a player more than $40 million, that being Marcell Ozuna. And the Braves did not pay the competitive balance tax until last year. For most of Anthopoulos' tenure, they've been outside of the top 10 for payroll. So, you know, he's kind of walked this line of not doing the huge free agent deals, which, you know, is generally a thing ownership loves.
Okay, well, let's get on to your questions. We got one here from Paul, who says, Ben Cherington has repeatedly said that he would be active in the market for another starting pitcher and another outfielder with spring training starting in about 1 month. Has he given up on this quest?
No, I don't think so. I think the idea is that the Pirates are still trying to add a starting pitcher. I think that they're trying to get somebody who's more interesting than Martin Perez and Marco Gonzalez, who have been the additions to this date. From kind of taking the pulse of Pirates fans, I think Yariel Rodriguez is the guy that they're putting their hopes on as somewhat reasonable. You know, Rodriguez being a Cuban pitcher who has been in Japan, who I think whose role is in a bit of question, whether he could start or relieve. But for a team like the Pirates, he would get a lot of runway as a starting pitcher. I would guess that they would otherwise be focused on the trade market. There was a connection to Imanaga with them. I don't think anybody knows how serious that was, if it got to the point of making an offer. But that was a free agent with a little bit of upside, but who wound up in a somewhat plausible price range for the Pirates. But if they're in the trade market, you still have Framber Valdez and Luzardo and Cease and Shane Bieber. And if they were to come away with one of those guys, I think the fans would be pretty happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we had on the site their interest in Imanaga and noted that the franchise record for free agent contract is still the $39 million given to Francisco Liriano. So I think Pirates fans will be hoping that's broken at some point, either in the next couple of weeks or next winter, some point.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts in today's day and age.
All right. Well, we have another question here from, I'm sorry, I've never encountered this name before, and I looked it up. I believe it's pronounced Kive, C-I-V-E. Okay. I hope I'm saying that right. If not, I apologize. Kive says, why do GMs not come out and say reports are BS? Use the Jays as an example. They are not interested in Snell, but their name gets thrown in for leverage. Should GMs step in and say the report is false? The endless number of sources is ridiculous and leads nowhere except larger paydays or trade hauls because of fake competition. Well, MLB trade rumors, this is your thing, Tim.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, who's to say the Jays aren't interested in Blake Snell? I mean, do you think that that's possible?
I think it's possible. I mean, if his market fell and, like, you know, Boris was looking to do some sort of like Carlos Correa thing where it was like a whole bunch of opt-outs, yeah, and like whatever. I could see it. I mean, they were in on Yamamoto, so.
Yeah, and this rumor, which I think suggested that the Jays are, quote, monitoring Snell kind of in case his price tag drops, it came from Bob Nightingale, USA Today. And I've highlighted this article that Bob wrote on this podcast before, but Bob estimated that at least 95% of rumors are leaked by the agents. And so in this case, using Bob's own logic, he probably got this information from the Boris Corporation to drum up interest, which, you know, matches kind of the point of this this reader is like, well, why are the Blue Jays letting themselves be used in theory? But the answer to that can be found in attachment 49 of the collective bargaining agreement. I did a little reading last night. I knew this, but I never really read the specific language until last night. But teams and agents are prohibited from saying certain things, but agents are not going to say that teams are out on their own free agents. So it's really kind of more applicable to teams. Teams are prohibited from saying we are out on player X. And so in the CBA, they give specific examples of things that cannot be said, and we are out on player X is literally in there as something that a team cannot say. So they just can't say that they're out on Blake Snell, period, or they're going to be punished or, you know, fined or whatever. And so Other things that teams can't say are that they're unwilling to forfeit a draft pick to sign Blake Snell, that they have, you know, concerns about the health of Blake Snell. All that stuff kind of collectively bargained that teams are not going to say those things. Interestingly, if the rumor was that the Jays had made Snell a contract offer, the Jays would be allowed to deny that. So, you know, there's a little clause in there where they can, if there's something that's kind of more factual and it's just not true, the Jays could come in and say that. But that's the answer.
I would also add that, you know, there's no reason for the Jays really to be against being used to drive up somebody else's price.
That's a really good point.
Like, if you're the Blue Jays and Scott Boras comes out and says you're interested in Blake Snell because he's trying to get more money from the Yankees or something like that, why would you deny that? Like, let the Yankees spend more money on Blake Snell than they want to. Because
Well, you do have different factions at play here, because you have kind of the GM who, in general, in these situations, would like other teams to spend as much money as possible. You know, driving up the price is in their interest in that way. But then you also have kind of the Blue Jays are part of MLB and Blue Jays ownership standpoint, where the goal is always to tamp down player salaries. So they don't want Blake Snell to get like some sort of record AAV because it might, you know, trickle down to future contracts, and their entire goal is to keep future contracts down. So I think that there's kind of a short-term picture and a big picture in terms of whether the Blue Jays would like somebody to overpay for Blake Snell. But that's an interesting point that you make, though.
Okay, let's move on to one more question here from Joshua, who says, I think most of the baseball world is getting really sick of the Dodgers and Yankees buying all the major names. It's terrible for parody and makes for season after season of wash, rinse, repeat storylines. Is the league ever going to enact a salary cap? It's done great things for the other three major sports leagues. What is the reason for the resistance to it?
So just pushing back a little bit on the premise, just because of those two teams that were named, the Yankees' biggest signing this winter has been Marcus Stroman for $37 million, which I think any team was capable of, including the Pirates or lower spender. But yes, the Dodgers have spent huge this winter. We know that. And both teams' payrolls are among the highest in the sport. And just a little bit of pushback on the idea that, you know, the big markets are the only team signing the bigger free agents. You know, we've seen top five free agent deals from the Padres, the Twins, the Rangers, the Rockies, the Tigers in recent years. And so there is definitely a pretty good correlation. I think it's like, I want to say 0.5 or a little less than that on average between a team's payroll and its regular season wins. So it helps for sure. But then if you look at last year was one of those low correlation years where you had the Mets and the Yankees and the Padres all miss the playoffs. So it's because of the randomness of the MLB playoffs, it's not easy to buy a championship, even if you try. But to answer Joshua's question, the reason for the resistance to a salary cap is that it's not in the player's interest. And I think that's pretty easy to understand. If you were one of the 1,200 members of the players union, I do not think you would vote to artificially limit your own earnings. So Tony Clark, who's in charge of the players union, has been very clear on this. He said, quote, we're never going to agree to a cap. He called it the ultimate restriction on player value and player salary. And I think to understand why MLB players union has this stance and other sports don't, you have to learn about Marvin Miller. And I'm not speaking to Joshua specifically. I don't know what Joshua knows. But if you're interested in baseball players' salaries and salary caps, I would highly recommend that you familiarize yourself with Marvin Miller, who I think is not as popular as he should be, given the impact that he's had on baseball. So Miller wrote a book. It's called A Whole Different Ball Game. You can pick it up for less than $20 or get it from the library, and I strongly recommend it. But, you know, just to sum it up quickly, he was the founder of the Players Union in 1966, and he's kind of on the Mount Rushmore of influential people in baseball history. And I think that the other sports just didn't stumble into a Marvin Miller, a guy with a Steelworkers Union background, the way baseball players did. And if you read Marvin Miller's book, the players definitely stumbled into him. They did not understand unions, and they did not like unions, and they were not setting out to get free agency down the road or something. But that was the type of person that Miller was, and he never would have agreed to a salary cap. He wouldn't have even agreed to a luxury tax. And he was just a skilled and tough advocate for baseball players. And you might like that or dislike that, but just in terms of understanding why players have this resistance, I would trace it to Marvin Miller.
Okay, well, that's all the time that we have for this week's episode. Like I said off the top, there's still lots to happen between now and spring training, or maybe even during spring training, knowing how Scott Boras operates sometimes. We still have Blake Snell out there, Jordan Montgomery, Matt Chapman, Cody Bellinger, Josh Hader, Dylan Cease trade, lots of stuff still to come. So keep checking out MLBTradeRumors.com. And if you sign up for the front office package, it's cheap. You get the ads off the site. You get extra stuff. You can use the contract tracker. It's a pretty awesome package. So do that. And you support us and allow us to keep doing stuff like this podcast. So we will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.com.